this country is at war with Germany.
We shall go on to the end.
I remember the sheets of flame which came up and almost blinded us from our guns.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. I seem to have had a good run of episodes this year looking at operations from the German perspective. Well, in this episode, we're off to the Pacific to look at the Japanese perspective of the war. I'm joined by Peter Williams. Peter lived in Japan for 4 years, and whilst there, he interviewed Japanese veterans of the Second World War. His book, Japan's Pacific War, collects together over 40 interviews with veterans who predominantly fought against the Australians. Peter, thanks for joining me. We're going to be looking at the Japanese soldiers' experience of the war, and I wonder how much the Japanese soldier knew of the world. You know, how was the war framed for them?
To save Asians from the white man. The Americans are in the Philippines, the British are in Malaya and Hong Kong, the Dutch are in what is now Indonesia, and this isn't right, you know, and the Japanese are going to solve that problem by freeing the Asians.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, do they also see themselves as being on par with, for convenience sake, the Western powers? Because if you think that they've obviously beaten the Russians in 1904, 1905, they're on the winning side of the First World War.
They beat the Chinese in 1898 too, I think. Yeah.
So do they see themselves, is there a resurgence in sort of a nationalism of these sort of victories and the nation building from that perspective?
Yes, of course. Yes, they think they're the greatest country in the world, and they've recently demonstrated that by beating the Chinese and beating the Russians. You know, they really think they are the people to liberate Asia because they're so good.
So who? Which is interesting, because is there perhaps a qualification there when you're liberating the Asians from the white man? Who are you liberating China for when you're going to Manchuria?
You can't have consistency right across the board, you know. You can't. But I mean, I think we can find some of the United States justifications for what they did in Hawaii and in the Philippines. We can find that there's sort of some inconsistency there with other things that the United States might say.
The West perspective, depending where you are, what the war starts in 1939, the Americans might be later. But for Japan, I think you could probably say this: the war starts with the invasion of China. So I wonder of the men you talk to, how did their military service start? Are they volunteers? Are they conscripted? And sort of from 36, is this a conscript army or is this actually a professional volunteer army? Because it's a black hole in my historiography of the period.
Yeah, it starts out as a professional army and becomes a conscript army pretty quickly. That's what happens as the war in China grows and grows.
So how do they feel about the military service? Do we see millions of men coming forward in droves when the war breaks out with China, or do they wait to be conscripted?
There's both of those things are happening.
It's one of the guys you talk to. He's conscripted for 2 years, but then serves for 9 years.
That's right. That's Sadashige Imanishi. He was a great interview. I went back to see him quite a bit. He lived in a little place called Motoyama in Shikoku. He was later the mayor of the village. Yeah, he did his 2 years in China, and then he went home to go back to teaching in the village, which is what he had been doing before. But then the World War II, as we understand it, breaks out in 1941, and the army just grab him again. I think they grab him a little bit before that in 1940, and he's just back in. He's conscripted again. And he says when he gets to New Guinea, he says in 1942, he says, look, I was just so sick of it. I'd done my bit. And it's just a classic line that translates so well. I'd done my bit, you know. And we're so familiar with Western soldiers saying, yeah, you know, I was at El Alamein or Tobruk or whatever. I've done my bit. I don't want to go to Normandy. That kind of thinking we're familiar with. Well, Sadashige, he felt that too. He'd done his duty in China, but he was over it.
when I was reading through the interviews, I kept trying to, without wanting to, try to parallel with Western memoirs. And you kind of think about when men are called up, this sort of, this idea, possibly the younger men who've never served before, of youthful enthusiasm. And, you know, there's that whole martial spirit of the Boy Scouts and Baden Powellers getting boys ready for the Empire. You get boys' own books like Biggles. And even now you get that resurgence in this idea of the boys' own sort of stories from the Edwardian period and pre-war that makes war seem like an adventure. I wonder, do the Japanese see it as sort of, when they're conscripted, is it do they potentially see it as an adventure, as something new, or is it just, I don't know, duty?
I think their attitude is a bit is more serious than that. I didn't come across the idea that it was an adventure. It's a duty. It's an honour. It's an honour to do your duty to the emperor. Many people said that. And like Sadashige, not everyone was delighted, but it was an honour to do the duty, do your duty by the emperor.
Well, I think that's an interesting difference in motivation. If it's an honour, it's a privilege.
It's an honour. It's not something. It's not a funny thing. It's not amusing. It's not really a grand adventure. You're duty bound to do this, and so you do it. One fellow told me that his mother had three sons who were all went away in the army. I don't recall if they were conscripted or volunteered, but she used to go around the village in the middle of the war saying, "Oh, look, I'm so ashamed. Not one of my sons has died for the emperor." The fellow I was interviewing said that's not what she really thought, but it was the thing to say. It was the attitude to have, that she had three sons. At least she could offer the life of one of them for the emperor. For the nation.
It comes back to that sort of idea of nationalistic nation building, where everyone's in it together, pulling it together, and I guess the emperor is at the pinnacle of that that they're honouring in their service.
That's it, and it's more than that. People tended to assume that they were going to die during the war. They were going to die for the emperor. That was, one fellow said, that was actually my plan. And when the war suddenly ended and I was still alive, it was kind of I was a bit surprised. And my plan hadn't, you know, it hadn't worked out at all. Now, he might have been an extreme case, I don't know. But there's certainly a sense that having taken the uniform and you have signed your life over to the emperor and you will offer it up at some appropriate occasion during the war. Yeah, whereas your typical Western soldier, he more likely says, "I tried to stay alive. I realized I might die, but I tried to stay alive if I could." And that's quite a different viewpoint.
It goes somewhere to explaining, you know, how the war plays out, I guess. So post Pearl Harbor, when the Americans and the British and the Australians and the Empire, for a better term, sort of join the war, do the Japanese soldiers view the European countries different from China? Because, you know, I've had these men fighting in China. There must have been quite a large cadre of very experienced troops from China who are now fighting the Americans and the British.
If anything, perhaps they hated the United States more. They didn't really have much of an impression of Australia. You know, some soldiers say, "I never heard of it." Some say, "I had no idea where it was." England was equally far away, though they'd heard of it. But the big bad guy in their book was the United States, because they had applied these trade embargoes on Japan and were ruining the economy. And this is what a lot of Japanese veterans would say, that, well, they put so much pressure on our economy that they were saying to us, look, here's your choices, fight or give in to United States demands. And they fought. Of course they fought. That's their approach, that, well, what? If you give us that choice, we're going to fight. So that's how they think they got into the war, because the United States put so much pressure on them that they just had to fight. These people were trying to ruin them. And to say Australia, England, the Dutch, they've got no particular feeling about them one way or t'other.
How do the Japanese soldiers view their Western opponents, you know, on the battlefield? Do they see them as equals, inferiors?
Inferior. You're definitely inferior. The view is that Westerners never had the courage to charge. They wouldn't charge. They would just, the Japanese view is that the Westerners would use their infantry just to find our infantry. Then they'd wait till they brought up all their artillery and their air power, and then they'd just blow the crap out of our infantry and then just walk in and take over. Whereas the Japanese way was a bit more of an idea that, that bayonet charges are things that are quite useful. And you do that occasionally, and Japanese soldiers, officers and privates just say, well, these Westerners, they had no guts. They would never charge. They'd never get the bayonet up and come at us. They won because they had a material superiority. We had the moral superiority. We were braver men. Bill Slim in Burma, you know, he said that every army talks about fighting to the last man, but only the Japanese actually do it.
Yes, but I guess you've got that thing from the Western point of view, as we went back to, you know, you're not dying for an emperor. So ideally you pin someone in position and then just flatten them with as much artillery and anything you can bring to bear before you send the infantry.
Makes perfect sense to us, but I have heard some veterans say that they felt it was a bit underhand, you know. It was a bit, you know, come out and fight fair, was the thinking of some people. Others saw it as just, well, that's practical. If the role were reversed, I would have done that too, other people. But, yeah, some of them thought it was all a bit underhand the way the West defeated them.
Where are they drawing on these ideas from? Is this part of military doctrine, or is this sort of culturally the way they've always done it? Sort of, I mean, it's easy to... I'm trying not to fall back on stereotypes, thinking about samurai and swords and things, but... where are they drawing this idea of the hand-to-hand bayonet charge as being...
Bushido, the way of the warrior. It's Bushido, still important in World War II.
And is that taught by the military, or is it just in the completely throughout the culture?
It's right through the culture. It still is today. You know, people will tell you, I'm from a samurai family, so watch out, you know, make a little joke. No, people know. But yes, the army and the navy... issued booklets about ways to behave in war, like recommendations, like don't ever live to experience the shame of being a prisoner of war. That's one I can remember. But so you tell him that, you know, this is the way it's done. You don't surrender.
I mean, that opening period of the post Pearl Harbor, it's a whirlwind of victories, and is just phenomenal at the success they have. Of the men you interviewed who took part in those campaigns, do they feel like they've won? I mean, they must have been grueling because it was pretty non-stop. I mean, did they think that was it? We've won? We're winners?
They were pretty happy about Singapore. I've interviewed a few guys who were there for Singapore, and they thought that was just terrific. They went and fought and fed all the grog they could find and drank as much as they could and chased after women and had parties, and they just had a great time. They were so pleased with themselves. Singapore was a wonderful time for them. The senior officer thought, well, that works so well. Maybe we should grab a little bit more of the Pacific. So they tried. So they're kind of a phase two after they've captured those raw materials, which is the reason they went south. They want the rubber from Malaya, tin. They want the oil, Borneo, Dutch East Indies. Quinine in Java, and now they've got it. But then there's this phase two. When phase one goes so well, they think, well, I think we can grab a few more things, and that's when it starts to unravel.
And when they're liberating the local people from the Western domination, how are they expected to interact with the locals? As you know, because in many respects. Wait, wow, when the British and the Canadians and the Australians set up whole units to follow up to reinstall civil administrations for self-rule and things after, you know, towards the end of the war. If they're liberators, how do they liberate?
Well, some of it's nice and some of it's nasty. There are many stories of, well, told by the soldier himself, of course, of being taken in by like a family in Sumatra who treat him like their own son and feed him up and find him a girlfriend or something like that, and he has a wonderful relationship with them, which sometimes continues after the war. And then on the other side, there was a fellow I interviewed who in Singapore, though there was a bunch of people who, as far as he could see, were civilians, were rounded up, and him and his platoon were told that they each had to bayonet two men to death. And he said, yeah, I had no idea who these people were, they might have been fifth columnists, but they might have just been civilians. But he just went ahead and bayoneted his two.
It's funny because it did strike me as one of the veterans you spoke to. You know, he said, carried on writing for years after the war to the family that he met. And that, again, that's not necessarily the narrative you read. It's their kind of...
No. And you're struck by it when you go to New Guinea and you see all these schools and medical clinics built by Japanese. And that's got a lot to do with the fact that the Japanese veterans went back to New Guinea after the war looking for the war dead. There were tens of thousands of them that had never been found. There were big organizations in Japan for the repose of the souls of the war dead. They'd go back, find the bones, take them back or cremate them, and they'd go back to the villages they fought in, and then they'd look around and say, well, we can build a school here. Those kinds of things. You don't hear much about that, but you can see those schools in New Guinea.
From the Australian point of view, I was going to talk about the Kokoda Trail, because the reminiscences of the Kokoda Trail in the book, which is usually horrific. But I was going to say, for those people who are unfamiliar with the Kokoda Trail campaign, do you want to give a brief overview? And then I was going to say, we'll look at Milne Bay, which is the first big Japanese defeat. So tell us about the Kokoda Trail, because there will be people who have no idea.
In eastern New Guinea, the Japanese wanted to capture Port Moresby. If they were ever going to invade Australia, and they had considered it, they would need Port Moresby, which is only 600 kilometres north of Cairns. It's got a harbour, it's got airfields, it's got storage facilities, it's got a big supply of fresh water. If you're going to launch an amphibious operation against Australia, Port Moresby is the only place to do it from. The Kokoda Track leads to Port Moresby from the north coast of the tail of New Guinea. There's 100 kilometres of what's called the San Ananda Road, or the Japanese called it that, and then that's pretty flat. And then there's 100 kilometres over the Owen Stanley mountain range. That's the Kokoda Track. The Japanese had planned to go straight to Port Moresby by sea, and there never would have been a Kokoda Track campaign, and they got stopped at the Battle of the Coral Sea. Now, if the Japanese had lost the Battle of the Coral Sea completely, they would have given up on Port Moresby, and there never would have been a Kokoda Track campaign. If the Japanese had won the battle, they would have landed in Port Moresby, and there would never have been a Kokoda campaign. But because the battle was a draw, the Japanese decided, okay, well, we can't do it by sea, but what about we land on the north coast of New Guinea and march over the mountains? And that's the Kokoda Track.
And it's there at Milne Bay in August, September 42. They're stopped for the first time on land, isn't it? Is it the first?
That's right. That's the first amphibious operation that didn't work.
Didn't work. So how does that affect the troops? Because it's, you know, you being a winner and...
Oh, the troops thought it was great. The army thought it was great. This is the Navy troops that got smashed in Milne Bay, and the army told them not to go. Wait for, there was an army regiment on the way. And the Navy said, no, we can do it. We'll get a few of our naval infantry battalions together and we'll land in Milne Bay. And they did, and they got smashed. People have talked about the Japanese naval infantry as if they were like Marines or United States Marines or something, but they're not. They're garrison troops for naval bases. They're not in any sense elite troops.
It's from that point that the Australians start to push back across, I'm right in saying, along the Kokoda Trail in the Owen Stanley Mountains, isn't it? It's at that point... The Japanese are going in reverse. So the troops, how is it for those troops as they're now being pushed back? It's hard to say that you're winning.
How was it for them? Well, they had never been pushed back before. Most people had not had the experience of being defeated. So that was quite a surprise to them. They didn't really think much of the Australian troops, but they thought they were better than the Chinese. Another thing that some of the Kokoda veterans said was that we were no longer at our best. We'd fought in China then, like 3 or 4 years, and we'd lost our best men, our best sergeants, our best company sergeant majors, our best platoon commanders and company commanders. They'd been killed or maimed in China, and when we got to New Guinea, we were no longer at our peak. And I hadn't heard that before. That was very interesting to me, them saying they just weren't all that. They didn't think they were all. They were as good as they had ever been.
You know, if you're expected to potentially die for the emperor and it's an honour and you're not supposed to be a prisoner of war, how do you face withdrawal? How do they view withdrawal?
Well, sorry, it's all right in the sense that you're not supposed to throw your life away. You're supposed to find an appropriate, I mean, what's the term? I can't think of the term in Japanese now, but it translates as to seek a useful place to die. Like, don't die stupidly. So, for example, you might, on the track, if you're retreating, you might volunteer to stay in the rear guard because you're going to kill three or four Australians as they come down the track, and then you'll die. But that'll be useful, taking three or four of them with you. But you don't die. You're not supposed to die in something stupid like a mass charge where you'll just lose heaps of men and not do a lot of damage to the enemy.
I have pictures of the Kokoda track in my head, you know, with those sort of mule trains and everybody's sort of slogging through the jungle. And oddly, it's horrendous for the Allies on that track, but it's even worse. I mean, it's horrendous for the Japanese. And the Japanese you interviewed have some, I mean, just awful memories of those trails. I wonder if you would tell us about some of those, what there was, because they're obsessed with food. I mean, your the book, all those interviews are essentially, there must be over half of them are a book of just, here is my food obsession at this period of time.
Well, as a general rule, in the second half of the war, Japanese in the South Pacific, and there were more than, well over 100,000 of them, oh, cut 200,000, were cut off on islands large and small, you know, New Guinea being one of them, New Ireland another, and they run out of food. They can't be supplied. The supply system can't get anything through to them. So the whole army naturally become obsessed with food. It's not always the case in the first half of the war. It is in particular, yes, on the Kokoda track, the force retreating, they run out of food. But I'm saying it in the majority of the interviews in the book, I think, that mention that are from the middle to the second half of the war, and that's because it is the general condition everyone's in, because they're on islands which are cut off from supply. So they're growing their own food.
But they're not just growing their own food. I mean, they go to quite extremes foraging as well, don't they?
Mm. Yes, they nearly wiped out the pig population of Papua. You can get 20 or 30 pounds of meat off a pig, and that'll sort of give the platoon a meal for the day. And so they went killing them.
Because they were shooting crocodiles. It was one island. What's the monkeys they were shooting? They discovered some monkeys. I want to say they were orangutans, and they probably aren't. And they were shooting those.
In Borneo, there were orangutans, yeah. But they orangutans often got shot accidentally at night because they moved through the jungle sounding like a platoon, and the Australians would open fire on them. I know that. The Japanese would too. And they often got themselves killed.
Because it's surprising, the physical condition that they get themselves into, they still don't surrender even when they somehow manage to keep going.
Well, they kill themselves. I mean, yeah, that happens. When the Japanese evacuated, Buna was the place they landed in order to start along the Kokoda Trail. And 6 months later, they're back at Buna. They're being surrounded by the Australians and the Americans, and they're being wiped out. So they stage a breakout, but there's many men too sick to break out. And these men are given a grenade, or perhaps they've got a pistol. But those that haven't, they're given a grenade and told, don't be caught, don't be a prisoner. We can't take you with us.
I mean, you did interview some Japanese who were caught as prisoners. How did they get captured? Were they willing to be captured?
Oh, sometimes their ship was sunk and they were sort of washed ashore with no weapons, and they were sort of half dead because they'd been in the sea for a few days, and they just, they weren't in top form, and they were easily captured. Sometimes that would happen. Sometimes it's the case that I'm just talking about the typical Japanese here, or most Japanese, but some people didn't buy the die for the emperor line, and when they saw an opportunity to surrender, they did. A minority, certainly did.
Were they surprised at the treatment they received from the Allies?
Well, it wasn't always nice. Yes, they were surprised if it was nice, but it wasn't always nice. Yuki Hayamichi, he was captured in Bougainville by the Australians. Oh, no, actually, he went into prisoner of war camp when the war ended. So he's there for several months till they're repatriated. And he was shocked when a couple of Australian officers broke into their hut, or came into their hut, and demanded all their watches. He was just stunned at this. He thought, officers doing this, this would never happen in Japan. there are quite a few stories of being badly treated and beaten up by the Australians, but they were fed. They were pretty happy about that they were being fed regularly.
Yes, I was going to try and draw an analogy that I don't know enough about Allied prisoners of war. They might have kept their watches, but they weren't fed. No good to you having a watch if you're starving.
No, compared to how the Japanese treated the Allied prisoners of war, yeah, they were well treated.
And the other thing I was surprised to read about, there is a mass breakout of one of the prisoner of war camps in Australia, isn't it?
In Cowra, in New South Wales, not far from Canberra, here where I am. The idea there was that the breakout was was the first part of the plan, but the second part of the plan was then you go outside and then you kill yourself, and you show the white man that how tough you are. And this is the sort of thinking. There was no prospect of a real escape.
Very alien thinking to break out so you could kill yourself.
It's different, isn't it?
These men who were prisoners of war, those who surrendered, how did they feel about surrendering? Did they feel it was something to be hidden?
When they got home, yes. The veterans organisations were very popular after the war, and everyone would go and join their regimental veterans organisation unless you'd been captured, in which case you wouldn't go. People have told me that one veteran told me that he... there was a bloke he used to meet, I don't know, on the bus to work every day, something like that. And this fellow had also fought with him in the same unit, but this fellow had been captured and spent time in Australia. So this fellow, whenever he knew there was a veteran meeting had been held the night before, he'd ask his friend, oh, what happened? Who was there? How'd it go? But he would never go himself. So he was fascinated to hear stories about the Veteran Association, but because he had been captured, he couldn't bring himself to go along to it. It was shameful.
The men you spoke to, how did they hear about the surrender of the war?
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
An interesting point. I once asked my father, how did you hear about the end of the war? And he was never quite sure how he knew that the Germans had surrendered. But, how did the Japanese troops hear about the war and how do they feel about the surrender?
There were leaflet drops, or in the case of up near Itapay on the north coast of New Guinea, they just noticed that the Australians had withdrawn. And they thought, that's odd. But they'd kind of had a suspicion that perhaps the war was going to end. Yeah, there were leaflet drops. There were planes flying overhead with something written under the wing. There were a number of things like that, and it took a while, but eventually they all got the message, except for those who ignored it and kept on fighting. A fellow who I interviewed who'd been on Tarakan, I said, what did you do when the war ended? He said, I kept fighting. I wasn't going to fall for that rubbish, I just kept fighting. And he kept fighting for a year till he was captured. He was wounded in a fight with, I'm not really sure who, the Dutch police, I imagine it must have been. Then he was sent home to Japan, but he just thought it was all rubbish that Japan had surrendered. He just didn't believe it would be true.
Was he shocked when he got home to discover that it had actually been a surrender?
Well, but he still wasn't convinced. One of his lines was, he said that when I got home, I saw that there was lots of green grass, and I'd been taught that as long as there's green grass to eat, you can keep fighting. And he said it wasn't kind of until I went to my hometown and saw that there was nothing left, it had all been levelled by bombing, that I realised, yeah, it's true, we lost. Some people were confused about that. They thought that the war had ended in an agreement between Japan and the Allies. Like one of them thought that we might have to hand back the Philippines or something, but we'll get to keep Malaya and China. This was his analysis of how it would all pan out. We'd give back a bit of ground, but we'd keep the bits we really wanted. When the emperor spoke about the surrender, a lot of people didn't understand him. They didn't know what he meant. They really had no idea. He spoke in a form of Japanese they didn't use themselves.
I've recently read that sort of part of the speech, and it isn't particularly clear what's happening, whether they've surrendered or what's going on. Lawyer speak is how it was described to me, of not admitting to something that you claim you're going to do. So you can kind of see why people were confused. How do they recall hearing the emperor? Did they believe it was him? He'd never been heard before, had he?
As far as I know, yeah, they believed it was him. It was just, it wasn't clear what he meant. The one fellow was on an ammunition ship off in the Tsushima Strait, and they heard the message, and apparently they understood, well, one of the fellows on the ship understood it loud and clear, because he jumped up and said, right, that's it, I'm going to blow the ship up. So he was heading down to where the ammunition was to blow it up and kill them all, because the war was over and Japan had lost. But he said that they restrained this fellow and stopped him doing that. Another fellow, Harada, a Zero fighter pilot. He was in Sapporo training pilots when the war ended. Him and his squadron mates got together and decided that they were going to resist. They would start to move munitions up into the mountains, and they would sharpen their swords, and they would, you know, if the Russians came, if the Americans came, they would fight and kill them. They weren't going to surrender. And he said, but what actually happened is a couple of Americans showed up in a Jeep one day and told them all to go home, and he said, and that's just what we did. So it was all a lot of talk, you know, nothing.
That might almost answer my next question, which I was going to ask, but, you know, if you're expected to die for the emperor at some point, and surrender comes and the war's finished and you're still alive, you know, how do men reflect upon that? Is there some shame of not having had the opportunity to die?
Some, but they're human too, you know. They're probably a bit pleased that they're still alive too. Some, but not compared to the shame of having been captured. That's a big hurdle for them to get over after the war, because everybody back home knows, you know.
There's so much about when you read those interviews that you kind of, it challenges your idea of, which is clearly a leftover from the war, of the Japanese sort of as automata troops who just banzai charge recklessly.
Well, there might be something in that later in the war, but early in the war, it's not like that at all. In New Guinea, the Japanese officers told me that they thought they had pretty good troops and they didn't want to waste them in stupid things like banzai charges, mass charges. They just didn't do it that way. They said, look, we could, you know, often we could just sort of worry the enemy out of their position with very few casualties. You go up at night and you start shouting at them and shooting, and you throw coconuts and you send a few guys around the flank. And he said, you'd be surprised who'll nick off under a few nights' pressure of that kind of thing. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't get their men killed. This is the army of 40, 41, 42, maybe even 43 there. The infantry is very good, and the officers don't want to waste it with anything. But you can't find anything in the Kokoda campaign. You can't find anything like a massed banzai charge. No such thing.
Oh no, I didn't realise that.
There are charges, because if, let's suppose, there's a Japanese platoon that has cleaned up an Australian platoon, but there's still a couple of guys left in the position, and there's some urgency to get in there and capture that position, then you might finish off the enemy with a quick charge. Sure, they might do that, but that's not what we're talking about when we think of these mass charges. That's just at a platoon level. There's no company charges, no battalion charges, nothing like that. It's just a waste of good infantry, and we don't like to do that.
So that's why you get this. I presume the Kokoda is that long rear guard action, presumably by a few troops, as the rest of them with continually a push back and withdrawal through a logistical failure. Is that what I'm probably, this is your bailiwick, isn't it? If your PhD is the Kokoda Trail.
That was New Guinea that beat them on the Kokoda track. Really, the rain came down, pushed away the supply line, and the guys in the mountains, the Japanese in the mountains on the Yon Stanley Range, just couldn't get any, no food could be got forward to them, but it was the weather. They had a supply system in place, and had it not been an unseasonably rainy September, things would have worked out better for them. But they are an old-fashioned army in a way, in the sense that they do rely upon living off the land to a degree. So they did make calculations that, for example, when we go to New Guinea, we only need to feed so many tons per thousand men per day, because about the other half of the food can be got off the land there, from the native gardens, from the wild pigs, various things like that. So that they are thinking that way, and that saves them supply. That saves them the problem of supply to a large degree. Saves them having to have such a long tail in an army, you know, of people who are supplying the forward troops and but can't be combat troops themselves.
It seems to me to be an anachronistic way of thinking, because you're taking troops away from actually your fighting to forage, and you are relying on forage to be there, which might not be there.
Well, they found it worked for them up until they started to lose. Then it obviously doesn't work very well. But it had worked for them. And this is historically, you know, you find this, that armies of the kind of Napoleon's army, that if they're continually advancing, they will find food. And it's great not to have to worry about the all the wagons and horses and men you need to keep the supply system going. Well, not so many. You can halve it, something like that. And that's sort of what the Japanese are thinking. We can halve the supply system. And it had worked for them in China, and it worked for years. And then around 1942, it starts not working.
Well, it worked in China because up to a point, presumably, they didn't care about the Chinese.
No, I don't think so. They don't. They didn't think less the Chinese. No, it's true.
And, so they don't care if they starve.
That's correct. Sure. Yeah, well, that's correct in New Guinea too. The when the Japanese go foraging, the natives don't have great surpluses of food. You know, they've got a bit of food to tide them over till the next crop, and the Japanese just come along and take that, and the tribe could starve to death. No, I wouldn't say they were concerned about that kind of thing.
Well, it's interesting because one of the veterans you talked to actually went and apologised, didn't he, for the. Okay, there's a story. Oh, it's on the Kokoda Trail. One of them had a native guide with them, and they've tried to prevent them.
Oh yeah, I think I know the one you mean. Yeah,
they tried to prevent him taking the food from the village because they say it has been disrespectful insofar as they had the native guide from the village.
That's about it. That's the retreat from Lay. Yeah, that's one of the stories in the book. That's not actually from an interview I did. I couldn't find anybody who'd survived the retreat from Lay to interview. So it was a Japanese officer's account of the retreat from Lay.
It was quite surprising the state some of them got in. You managed to find any of them because it's when they were talking about going out and stealing food from dead Australians or even toothbrushes. They don't have toothbrushes. You think, what kind of state are you in when there is absolutely nothing? Your logistics have broken down to the point of you just being starving.
Yeah, there's a fellow from Buna. This battle, I said, that lasted a couple of months and was at the end of the Papuan campaign, the end of the Kokoda Trap episode, when the Japanese are surrounded and backed to the sea at Buna. Now, there they are completely cut off and they are starving. And one of the veterans who told me that he had eaten humans, he thought he'd eaten Americans. He said to me that if some veteran ever tells you they were at Buna and they survived and they didn't eat human flesh, they're lying. If you wanted to live, you ate human flesh.
You know, after the war, how do they reflect upon their former enemy? Obviously, there's a political shift in the world, and they find themselves as allied with the Americans in the West. But how do they view their former enemies at the end of the war?
A variety of opinions. This is one of the big lessons for me in interviewing hundreds of veterans, is that they're as varied as all the people you know in their opinions about things. Some people now think the Americans are great because they're nearly as good as the Japanese. Other people, other veterans, are bitter about the way that Japan has turned, in their view, into a kind of a copy of America in many respects. And they are really bitter about that. I feel very sad about that.
You're obviously an outlier of being Australian interviewing them. How do they find telling their reminiscences to an Australian? I guess you're kind of, you're not American, you're not British. Are you seen as sort of neutral?
Fine. I mean, they generally have a nice view about Australia. And one fellow said that he wasn't aware that he was fighting Australians until I telephoned him and wanted to explain who I was and ask if I could come and interview him. And as I said before, America was the big bad guy, and everyone else is sort of all right. You know, they don't really express any bitterness towards the Dutch, or towards Australians or towards the English. But the Americans are some of them are still very bitter about. Yeah, no, they were a play. They quite liked talking to me. Sometimes. A few said to me, look, I fought at the Battle of Shaggy Ridge. Can you find an Australian veteran who fought at Shaggy Ridge? I'd love to meet him. Can you line that up for me? You know, I feel a sort of a, you know, after all these years, a camaraderie with the enemy that I fought, and I'm sure we'd just get along fine. One I tried to, but then I found exactly the right Australian to speak to, but then he died before anything could be arranged to. But others, no, I didn't manage to line anything up, but they thought that would be a great idea to meet the former enemy. Some of them certainly wouldn't do that if the enemy was American.
As I said before we started, I found your book fascinating. It really brings home how the Japanese are the same but also very different. Thanks, Peter. Loyal listener, Peter's book is Japan's Pacific War. It is an eye-opener and worth picking up. I will put a link on the website. We need to thank David Philipson at the History Guild for suggesting I have a chat with Peter and putting me in touch with him. If you are in Australia and would like to know more about the Pacific War and the War in New Guinea, History Guild is supporting a conference examining the battles of Gona, Buna and Sanananda. It is on the 12th of November, that's 2022 if you're listening in the future, and will take place in Melbourne. Everyone is welcome, so if you are interested, you can find out more and register at historyguild.org/beachheads. So next time, I'm hoping to be joined once more by Prit Buttar to discuss the war on the Eastern Front. So until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Jerry 88mm gun hit our tongue, blew us the hell out of it.
Stalingrad can never be repaired.
As Allied Commander-in-Chief, I have granted a military armistice.